Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is the former Deputy Secretary of the Treasury, renowned investment banker, and founder and senior chairman of Evercore, Roger Altman. Remember, we love to take your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. And please check out the links to this week's sponsors, Real Paper, Blinkist, and The Jordan Harbinger Show in the show notes. We thank you for supporting our sponsors. It helps make this podcast happen. Please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast. James, we have a lot of election politics to cover, but that seems almost irrelevant when 19 little children and several teachers were killed in a fourth grade classroom by a gunman in Uvalde, Texas. You know, mass gun violence is commonplace in America now. Typically, we saw it in Buffalo Market last week. Before that, several years ago, Parkland High School in Florida. Several years before that, Sandy Hook Elementary School. Before that, Columbine. And the sad reality, I believe, is that nothing is going to change. The power of the gun lobby and ill-informed members intimidate politicians. When this was all happening yesterday, Ted Cruz, even while some of these children were dying, they hadn't even gotten to the hospital yet, assailed Democrats for advocating gun control. Cruz is just a craving coward. Mitch McConnell said he was heartbroken, not heartbroken enough to do anything about it. And Marco Rubio said, there's nothing we can do about it. I want to require, if I could, Cruz, McConnell, and Rubio to listen to the Golden State Warriors coach Steve Kerr, who before a big game last night discarded all of his basketball remarks and instead made this passionate plea.
I'm not going to talk about basketball. Nothing's happened with our team last 6 hours. We're going to start the same way tonight. Any basketball questions don't matter. Since we left shoot around, 14 children were killed 400 miles from here and a teacher. And in the last 10 days, we've had elderly black people killed in a supermarket in Buffalo. We've had Asian churchgoers killed in Southern California. And now we have children murdered at school. When are we going to do something? I'm tired. I'm so tired of getting up here and offering condolences to the devastated families that are out there. I'm so tired of the, excuse me, I'm sorry. I'm tired of the moments of silence. Enough. There's 50 senators right now who refuse to vote on H.R. 8, which is a background check rule that the House passed a couple of years ago. It's been sitting there for 2 years. And there's a reason they won't vote on it, to hold on to power. So I ask you, Mitch McConnell, I ask all of you senators who refuse to do anything about the violence and school shootings and supermarket shootings, I ask you, are you going to put your own desire for power ahead of the lives of our children and our elderly and our churchgoers? Because that's what it looks like. It's what we do every week. So I'm fed up. I've had enough. We're going to play the game tonight. But I want every person here, every person listening to this, to think about your own child or grandchild or mother or father or sister or brother. How would you feel if this happened to you today? We can't get numb to this. We can't sit here and just read about it and go, well, let's have a moment of silence. Yeah, go Dubs, you know. Come on, Mavs, let's go. That's what we're going to do. We're going to go play a basketball game. And 50 senators in Washington are going to hold us hostage. You realize that 90% of Americans, regardless of political party, want background check, universal background check. 90% of us, we are being held hostage by 50 senators in Washington who refuse to even put it to a vote, despite what we, the American people, want. They won't vote on it because they want to hold on to their own power. It's pathetic. I've had enough.
You know, James, then they say it's not about guns, it's about mental health. Of course it's about mental health. It's about both. As President Biden noted, other countries have similar mental health challenges. They just don't have massive gun murders.
Well, there's actually an explanation for it. In 1994, the Clinton-Biden crime bill, actually had an assault weapons ban that expired in 2004. Of course, the Bush administration and the Congress decided in its wisdom not to extend an assault weapons ban. The math is very simple. How many assault weapons did you have in the United States in 1994? And how many did you have in 2004? And how many you have now? You can do the math. It's about mental health. The courts have struck down large parts of states. Brady Bill barely enforced it. You had all of those sort of checks against this. The truth of the matter, and it's frustrating to say, it's not going to make a shit. Because in the Democrats, the Republicans will go, they'll lie. They'll get the NRA, get money. They have the convention in Houston. Trump is speaking to half. They don't give a shit. And Democrats are not going to vote. And it's going to get worse. You had a solution, and all we did is sit there. You know, we'd done something, and done, you know, President Biden, President Clinton had done something. By the way, if anybody wanted to look at the crime rates between the time the crime bill passed and the last year of the Trump administration, I invite you to do that. Put us on. I mean, I think what Coach Kerr said was elegant and passionate and true and moving. Unfortunately, it's not going to change anything. People were hunting in 1998. They really were. They were going to gun clubs and they were practicing marksmanship and everything. But they had something. We had something. This country was working. When we unearthed the errors of the Bush 43 administration, we'll be digging for eternity to see how bad it was.
Yeah. This is such a tragedy, James. I was watching.
I don't know if you do now. I'm going to do any good to ban them all. There's so many of them out there.
Yeah. Well, it would help. I mean, this deranged killer purchased an assault weapon, an A-15, weeks after his 18th birthday, and maybe he could have found it elsewhere. I'm not sure. If it stops one, if it just stops one,
we don't have to see that. I'm for it. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
I'm just saying we had them.
No, I know you are, but I was right, and it would have made a difference. I was watching television Wednesday morning, and about the third time they showed the pictures of that little kid, I just started to cry and had to stop. It is so tragic. It is so sad. And one thing I will assure you, James, there will be more. More children will be murdered. Course, because we won't do anything about it.
Of course. And we'll see stories, you know, about Democrats don't want to vote. I don't, you know, and I'm beginning to, you know, maybe it's just so depressed by this. But, man, if you see what they're doing, what this court is doing, the way they treated this Justice Jackson, if you see this Buffalo, you see this thing in Uvalde in South Texas, you see this leaked Supreme Court opinion. You know, if that doesn't motivate you, I don't know that there's, I can think of anything else. If you're not motivated to vote, if you're not motivated to donate, if you're not motivated to do something, I actually think you're probably a shitty person. And maybe we got too many shitty people in this country. I'm really beginning to think that. You need a slogan. Okay, we'll try to get a slogan. We'll try to get a soundbite, but. Boy, if you're looking at this stuff, if this doesn't, you know, you take a look at Ted Cruz and you say, you know, I think I'm going to not vote and give that guy more power, because that's what you're doing. If you don't care, that's just what it is. You're signaling your approval, and he kind of knows that you don't give a shit. You know, he knows that you're going to hoo-ha and whop and say this and how depressed you are and how terrible it is. And you just go back. Diddy bopping around doing things the way you've always done them, and things are going to happen, and they're going to happen in the future. We actually had really addressed this issue. We'd addressed it successfully, and we just let it go. And that's the price you pay for bad policy. Horrible policy. It's, you know, I wish I had some kind of a more different thing.
You know, I hope you're wrong. I fear you're not, but I hope you're wrong. But if given all the events of given Donald Trump, given his lies, given that leaked Supreme Court likely verdict, and given what happened today, if Democratic voters want to stay home in November, they'll get what they deserve.
They'll get what you're right. And they can say, well, we didn't canvass enough, or, you know, that we didn't have a good enough message. And I mean, I'm sure all that's true at some level. But basically, you're just signaling your tacit nonchalance. I'm not saying you're signaling your approval, because I don't think that. I think that's too much. You're just kind of nonchalant about kids getting birded left and right. And, you know, you look at, you know, even you look at this, the COVID response. I mean, you get what you want. Two point three times more likely to die if you live in a Trump county than a Biden county. I don't know if you don't. We don't care. You just wait. Women's health issues. Oh my God! But the environment. You know, we've been in Australia. They had an election where climate was front and center. You couldn't get five votes in the United States running on do something about climate change. People. I don't know. They're not motivated. The whole freaking place is on fire, but the last thing we're going to do is vote. And, you know, there'll be all the rural whites will be out and flocking in droves, and I guess that's what's going to happen.
Well, there were a number who did flock in droves yesterday. They were Tuesday, rather. They were major primaries. And the theme among the sub-establishment Republicans is that Trump suffered major setbacks.
Well,
I fear that's an exaggeration of hope. He embraced two stupid candidates in Georgia who were beaten by two very conservative Republicans, Governor Kemp and Secretary of State Raffensperger. They did refuse to help Trump steal the 2020 election in that state. But also, let's not forget, in northwest corner of that state, that Trump-supporting, hate-mongering Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, easily won nomination. But the one that just fascinates me, maybe more than any, was the Texas Attorney General runoff. And the state incumbent Attorney General, Ken Paxton, he's under state indictment for securities fraud and under a very serious FBI investigation, as his own former assistants have accused him of bribery. He, by 2-1, defeated George P. Bush of the Bush family fame. This guy Paxton had Trump's wholehearted embrace. George P. sold his political soul by embracing Trumpism. It didn't do any good. He was beaten by voters who saw the crook as more authentic. I guess he really, really is. And he won in a rout. So Trump is going to lose some, but sadly, this is still very much a Trump Republican Party.
Trumpism doesn't lose very much, all right? And the idea is that, well, if we move beyond Trump, we'll go back to John Heinz. No, you're not going to do that. Mm-hmm. George H.W. Bush, you're not going to do that. The whole party is... I agree with Kathy Barnett, the woman in Pennsylvania. It's about MAGA. It's not about Trump. And MAGA is as healthy as it's ever been. As healthy as it's ever been. And if somebody comes in with a MAGA message, they'll vote for them. You know, Trump is not the essential player in this. It's the MAGA voters that are the central player. And I think that's what you saw in Texas. You know, Raffensperger ran as, you know, the only thing he wouldn't do, which was credible and which was good, that he wouldn't steal an election for Trump. But he has a totally Trumpist view of the world. So does Kemp.
And of election laws, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
And, you know,
look at, you know.
You used to tease me, James, saying that I, you know, had an endless search for the good Republican, but I knew a lot of good Republicans. I didn't agree with them on a lot of things. Howard Baker, George H.W. Bush, Bob Dole, you could disagree with them, but they were a different breed totally. MAGA really is synonymous with hate. That's what these people are. They are hate-filled. There may be an exception or two, but not very many. They play the race card. They play the fear factor. And right. And they really are different than your father's Republicans.
You know what? No, see, this is where I differ with you. And I'm not saying you didn't have.
Yep.
Where I differ with you, it's not the politicians. It's the voters. The people who vote in Republican primaries are driving this behavior. I mean, if you just wanted to look at the greatest weather vane of the 21st century, look at Lindsey Graham. He wouldn't be, Lindsey Graham would be, if anything, to stay in power. The reason he's at MAGA, because that's what the majority of the people in South Carolina want, quite clearly. They look spineless because they're just following the dictates of the voters of their state. And also they know that the Democrats are not going to do shit about it. They're just going to sit around and complain and you know, talk just the same normal bullshit they do. But until we – I'm sorry. George Carlin was right. The public sucks. They just do. And we always think everything is, you know, top heavy. If we just had one courageous Republican politician, well, look what's going on. Alan Kinzinger was a courageous Republican. He can't run for re-election. All the people that voted on that, they can't even run for re-election. It doesn't do, I mean, you can. It shows how spineless you are. It's kind of sort of watched to go them in some kind of an ideological pretzel. But it's the less of what I call the lessomatics question. He said, you know, the problem with Georgia prisons is the quality of the inmate. The problem with the Republican Party is the quality of the voter. Very low quality, very, very, very low quality people, but there's a lot of them.
Well, I don't, surely, you know, of course that's the case. I would just argue, and it's always been there, it's nonsense to say it just began in 2015 or 16, but Trump accelerated it. He exacerbated it.
Yeah.
I mean, 2008 and 2012, we could have had a lot of objections to John McCain and Mitt Romney, and we did. But they were, again, a different breed than what we're seeing today. But they just were.
But they didn't run against anyone. What Trump did is he just ran full varnished, and people responded. They were already there, right? They were already there. And look at how much better he did in turnout in his areas, in these rural white areas. He lit the fuse on an existing bomb.
Okay, we're with our economic oracle, Roger Altman. Roger, for the first time in 40 years, I hear and read talk of stagflation, sluggish economy and high inflation like we had in the 70s. Is that a serious danger?
I don't think we're in danger of the type of prolonged stagflation that we saw in the 70s, which lasted 4 or 5 years, depending on how you measure it. But we are going to go through at least an interim period where growth will be slowing, which after all is the purpose of the Federal Reserve's change in policy, and inflation will be coming down at a slow and stubborn rate. But I do think that over the next year and a half, we'll see inflation come down a lot. And while it's possible we could have a recession, keeping in mind that that's defined as two consecutive quarters of negative growth, mm-hmm. or 6 months of negative growth, I think we're probably going to avoid that. Maybe there'll be a month or two or something like that of negative growth, but I think we're going to avoid a traditional true recession. And I think 2 years from now, inflation will be back to let's call them acceptable long-term levels, like 2%, which is the Federal Reserve's goal. And there's no reason to think that the economy then won't be growing. How fast it's growing, I don't know. So I don't see us re-entering the late 70s and early 80s, no.
Well, that's welcome. But all right, 2 years from now, inflation's down to 2% or so. What will it be in 6 months from now?
Well, our forecast at our firm is that the going out inflation rate at the end of the year, in other words, the rate going forward will be 4% or 4 to 4.5%. So it will not be back down to levels that we all would like, be comfortable with, or that the public will like. It's just going to take longer than that.
But by election day, down to probably below 5%, at least, better than 8%.
Hard to tell, because in any given month, the numbers can move around, you know, various types of noise in the numbers, for example. But that's as good a guess as to where inflation will be on election day. Keep in mind that there's so many different ways to measure inflation. The Federal Reserve uses something called the personal consumption expenditure deflator. A lot of the American people generally look at the consumer price index. Some people look at core CPI, which is consumer price index without food and energy. But I think most Americans say to themselves, what's a gallon of gasoline going to cost? And what's a pound of chicken going to cost?
Yep.
Or groceries like that.
Yeah. Roger, how much of our current inflation, which is not unique to America, it's throughout much of the Western world, how much of it is attributable to the pandemic, where with pent-up, consumers splurge when we open up, and also the supply chain problems, and how much of it is attributable to expansive fiscal policies?
Well, keeping in mind that the fiscal policy was a response to the pandemic,
mm-hmm.
the pandemic was directly and indirectly responsible for all of it. But let's break that down. What really happened, if we all remember so well, COVID erupted in March 2020,
mm-hmm.
Very severely, and we had a national lockdown. And as a result, Americans were essentially staying home. And they were not spending money on several of the usual week in, week out matters they spend on, like going out to eat or staying in a hotel or taking a flight somewhere. And so the spending side of their household budgets went down. At the same time, the federal government unleashed, as it should have, a giant monetary and fiscal response, because initially the economy came almost to a halt after the lockdowns took place. And there was great fear that we were entering into a very deep and long recessionary period. And as a result, those same American families staying home and not spending and seeing their cash balances go up also were receiving handsome checks from the federal government. The average, an American family earning $75,000 received, I believe, $7,600, all said and done, through several different distributions from the federal government. So their traditional spending was going down. They were getting checks from the federal government. And after a couple of months of sharp fall, the stock market turned around and started going up very sharply. And ultimately, before very long, made all-time highs. So a lot of families, either through their IRAs or however else, were feeling flush for that reason. And so the American family, so many American families, obviously not everyone, were feeling cash rich. They had a lot of money. And they couldn't spend it again on some of these traditional things, so they started spending it on goods. Everything from bicycles to new cars to homes, every imaginable kind of home improvement, you name it. And prices for all those goods, consumer electronics, for example, in face of this sharp demand, went up, because the production side of the economy, not just for pandemic-related supply side problems, supply chain problems, just couldn't keep up with that demand. So prices went up, and they went up a lot. Anybody who tried to buy like a bike knows that. As we get pretty far out from that original COVID outbreak, that type of demand is beginning to slow down. Used car prices, for example, have come off their peak.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the services side of the economy, which is fundamentally driven by, well, not driven by, but centered around wages, and of course, service labor, wage rates began to rise. And it's a good thing in many respects that they did. But wages are running around 5% right now, year over year growth. And obviously that's not consistent with the 2% long-term inflation rate. And so the real challenge medium term is going to be, in terms of getting inflation back down, is going to be to cool off the economy generally, but in particular wages. Everybody wants wages to rise, but it's not that fast. And that's going to take a while because they've only been rising for a few months. There's a lot of momentum behind that with a 3.5% unemployment rate and with a lot of industries basically declaring that they're facing labor shortages. And so it's going to take, that's why I say it's going to take till maybe the end of 23 to get the inflation rate back to a level that everybody would be comfortable with. That's the situation we're facing.
James.
Hey, so Roger, I want to amplify because you're talking about the thing that really interests me. And I read some of these financial blogs and stuff, and some people follow the Baltic Dry Index or some such thing as that, and others follow the difference between a yield on a 2-year treasury and a 10-year treasury. The thing that I follow is the differential between the CPI and wage growth. And it looks like just, you know, back of the envelope calculation right now is the CPI is exceeding wage growth, maybe 2.3%, yes. Call it that, right? And is there, by October, do you see any chance that that becomes very narrow or it goes anywhere in favor of wage growth where people feel like they have something to lose? Or does normally is wage growth more sticky than other things?
Well, by October, we could have a situation. Well, let me step back a second. Right now, wages, as I said, are running at about a 5% annual year-over-year increase. But the most recent consumer price index figure was 8.5%. So the American worker, including all of us, is going backward in terms of real wages.
Right, right.
Because they're giving up more on the inflation side than they're getting on the pay increase side. By October, I think that, James, could have evened out. In other words, wage growth could still be in that 4 or 5% plus zone, and inflation may have come down to the same general level. So workers are being at least held even rather than losing.
Right.
But what the public focuses a lot on, as you know better than me, is, I said, the price of gasoline and the price of certain basic groceries like meat.
Right.
And you know, global oil prices are really high. They're in the vicinity today of 110. And because of a looming food crisis that we're beginning to move into, a lot of which is caused by the war in Ukraine, because Ukraine and Russia are both such huge suppliers of basics like wheat, it's hard to see meat prices and certain basics like that come down, but I think there's a chance that in October, the wage increase rate and the basic consumer price index are about the same.
So, but what I'm driving at is for this: if the Democrats have any chance to stave off disaster, it'll have to be that voters feel like they have something to lose. And if, let's say, it's even in October, the differential between the CPI and wage growth, I think if they will feel at some level, well, you know, it's a little better than it was 5 months ago. And if they think they could lose wherever it is, it could lead to a different kind of voting behavior. That's my general point is, you know, it's in politics or anything else, if you and I start the month with $100,000 at the end of the month, you know, you have 100 and I have 110. Well, I feel, you know, it's what you would expect to get that people really, really get to. So if they expect that things are starting to get a little bit better, they may be more reluctant to make a change. At least that's the hope when you're trying to think of things to hope about. That, well,
well I, I don't know if this answers your question, but if I were in the White House, first of all, I'd be talking a lot more about inflation than they are. About a week ago, Biden said that it was his number one domestic priority, quote unquote. And there have been a lot of things happen in the interim, including some terrible things. But I haven't heard much about that since. And even though it's hard for the executive branch to really fight inflation, that's mainly the job of the Federal Reserve, they've done a few things that they don't seem to talk about much, but are worth talking about. You know, unclogging the ports, putting more truckers on the road, releasing oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, this new program to expand the supply of new homes. These are good steps that may take a while, but they're directed at fighting inflation. And if I were the White House, I'd be talking more about them and just talking about how every morning I wake up and I think about what I can do today about getting inflation down. Then by the time October comes around, and if inflation is indeed down from, say, 8.5 to 5, they'd be in a position to say, you know, we're headed in the right direction. We've been working hard on this. We got a ways to go, but we're going in the right direction.
So before I turn it over to Al, and I've talked to a lot of people that do focus groups, and it what's kind of surprising is they blame corporate greed more than they do Biden. They don't think he's very effective to deal with it. But if you talk to, if you look at a focus group, says they see this as an opportunity to raise taxes. I mean, you transition between both worlds. How much you think? Do you think corporations are taking advantage of this atmosphere to raise taxes more than justified? And is there anything to be done about that if they are?
It's a really good question. There are some industries which are very concentrated, like meatpacking, which the Biden administration has pointed out and is challenging in terms of the concentration there.
Right.
Where what I would call the oligopoly nature of that industry means that they may be raising prices more than their input costs are going up and taking advantage of it. But generally speaking, no. I think businesses are primarily trying to stay even with inflation and not try to take advantage of it and gouge the public. Are there some examples of gouging? Yes, I think there are. Is it the main event? Is that what's really going on here? I don't think so. But it's hard to explain that to the public. I mean, for example, I think most of the public doesn't really understand why gasoline is 4.25 or wherever it is at your local station. 4.25, 4.50 where I am, a gallon. And you know, people think the oil companies are gouging them. And I'm not a student of the oil industry, and so I can't say that there's absolutely none of that going on. But and people always say that oil, gas prices go up quickly and come down slowly. There's probably truth in that. But I don't think what's really going on in terms of gasoline is gouging, because, you know, most populous parts of this country, there's 4 gasoline stations within a half a mile. And pretty competitive.
Right. Albert?
You mentioned the administration could probably do a better job articulating some of the good things they've done. But other than that, Roger, their options are pretty limited, aren't they?
Yes, because right now we have to cool the economy off in order to get demand down and inflation down, or at least the rate down, the rate of increase down. And that's really the job, and always has been in the modern era, of the Federal Reserve and monetary policy, which is why they've undertaken now such a change in monetary policy in terms of tightening it. But I think medium term, some of these actions the administration is talking about are good actions and are worth talking about, even though they're not nearly as important or powerful as what the Federal Reserve is doing.
Well, let me ask you about the Fed then. You know, some critics charge that they waited too long to tighten.
They did.
Others charge they're tightening too much now. How would you grade the Fed?
Waited too long. Hard to understand why they waited so long. And really a low moment, I think, for the Federal Reserve, even though 2.25 years ago when COVID erupted, the Fed was heroic in terms of unleashing a huge, multifaceted and somewhat creative response at that time. But this time, they waited too long. They let inflation get much too high. And as to whether they're tightening too much, the answer is no. After all, the federal funds rate, which is the rate the Federal Reserve does control, so-called overnight rate, mostly affects loans between banks, is 1%. And by any historical standard, that's extremely low. They've just begun to tighten. They've had literally two interest rate hikes, federal funds rate hikes so far, one of 25 basis points, one of 50, or maybe three. And the funds rate's 1%. There's nobody can look around and say, wow, that's too tight, because it isn't. At a 1% funds rate, the monetary policy is still supporting an expansion of the economy, not a restriction. So they have a ways to go before monetary policy gets really actually tight in the sense that it constraining the economy. They're not even there yet.
Roger, let me ask one more before I turn it over to John Maynard Carville to wrap this up. I usually don't pay a whole lot of attention to the vicissitudes of the market. It's kind of hard not to after the last 3 months. Is it a leading indicator? Is it telling us anything?
Well, I think there are two principal explanations at a high level. One is when monetary policy is tightened, particularly after a long period of ease, historically it's bad for stocks almost every single time, simply because when interest rates go up, it pays people to hold various types of bonds, including short-term bonds, a little more than it did a month ago or 2 months ago as compared to stocks.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, the whole purpose of the tightening of monetary policy, which, as I just said, is just beginning, is to cool off the economy, and that will cool off corporate profits. And that will mean, just kind of arithmetically, moderated stock prices or lower stock prices. I don't think it's signaling something worse than that, because stock prices were so high before, you know, as 3 months ago or so before the correction started, and in some cases, hard to explain how high they were, in tech sector, for example. So I don't think the turbulence in the stock market is saying, wow, we're headed into a long, dark economic hole. I think it's just a typical correction of the type that happens when interest rates start to go up after a long period of being low or zero, and where we're going to be facing a weaker economy than we've had, even though I don't think it'll be a disaster.
James?
So Roger, this is the point that people are saying, well, just explain to us, what is a basis point? If you say they raised a half a basis point, what does that mean to ordinary guys sitting there?
Well, so let's take the mortgage rate. Okay. So the average mortgage rate in the United States about 4 months ago, 5 months ago, and I think this is published by Fannie Mae, I could double check that, was 3%.
Okay.
On longer term mortgages. Now, as of a week ago, it was 5.57%.
Okay.
So the difference between 3% and 5.57 in the way the market thinks of it is 257 basis points, with each basis point, as you can see, being being a percentage of a full point increase. In other words, interest rates have gone from 3% to 557. The way the market talks about that, it's 257 basis points. It's 2.57 points, which is the way the basis point language works.
Right. Okay. So if it went from 3 to 4, it'd be 100 basis points.
100 basis points. That's right.
Right. Okay. The reason that
used so widely is because on an average day in the bond market, you know, bonds move mostly by very small amounts. You know, if you look at the 10-year treasury, which is the most widely followed bond, you know, an average day would be the 10-year treasury was 284, now it's 287.
Right.
And so you have to have a fine-tooth comb to measure it, and that's where basis points come in.
And that we're getting hit with a lot of basis points right now. They're coming over.
Most people think the federal funds rate is going to get toward about 3%. As I said, it's about 1%. Maybe not quite that high, but we'll see. And so that's another 200 basis points from 1 to 3, if in fact it gets that high. So interest rates are going to go up further. There's no doubt about it.
No, I just like want to go back to it. And of course, one individual taking one trip to one place hardly is indicative of anything. But man, I got to tell you, I went out to Los Angeles, and if the airport is any indication of the economy, and I know that's a hard thing to extrapolate, it sure doesn't feel like negative growth out there. I can tell you that.
Well, we don't have. That's a good point, James. And by the way, I took the shuttle to Washington a couple of days ago, and the airport was packed.
Couldn't move.
From New York. I was in New York. But
same
we don't
thing
have
with Boston. Now. We went to Boston. Same thing.
We're still growing. We're growing right this minute, probably at about 2%, maybe a little better. So we're not in recession, and we're not flat either. We're still growing. It's just that the rate of growth has come down some.
Right. Well, like I said, I used to, think about what the airport was like in terms of what interest rates were going to do, but there's still a lot of demand out there that I can see. Oof, a lot.
Well, yes, and we have a 3.5% unemployment rate, which will probably go down a little bit further. And so, by normal standards, this is a very good economy right this minute.
And households are in decent shape, aren't they?
Oh, very good shape. Household net worth is very high levels.
Right. I just saw the 2021 numbers, and they were impressive.
Yes, and consumer debt is not at very high levels, so the household balance sheets are really in quite good shape. Even though retail sales right now are weakening, and that's maybe one of the weakest parts of the economy right now, that comes after a very long period of very high retail sales.
Right.
But again, the economy is still growing, and with the exception of inflation, which is a very important exception, it's in good shape now.
All right. I mean, thank you.
Well, we've certainly learned.
Yeah, we have learned a lot, and I think our listeners have.
Thank you, Roger Altman. I actually feel a little bit better than I did a half hour ago. So let's hope it keeps getting better with that. And I hope, we know interest rates are going to go up, but if we're not going to have a repeat of the 70s, maybe in a year or two we'll be in pretty good shape.
Well, that's the goal.
I feel like I'm watching a horse race and the CPI and wage growth, and wage growth is a little behind coming around the final turn, and you're saying, boy, if we can just.
Well, think of wage growth as rich strike.
There you go.
Oh, yep. Man, rich, huh?
81
I
to
like
1.
80, go. 80
I love,
to 1.
Love listening to the replay of that race. I must have listened to it 30 times.
I was in Las Vegas watching it, and I mean, you just watching the people when it's happening. Of course, the horse made the move, and it must have been 200 yards for the finish line. You kind of knew he was going to win, and but it was just amazing. A lot of people lost money. A lot of people were happy. It was such a moving thing.
Well, what I thought was also cool was that the track announcer. The official track announcer was so focused on the two leaders, Epicenter and the horse, that he didn't see Rich Strike until the last second himself.
Yes. Right. Yes. Yes.
And it was amazing.
Yeah. I had to watch the replay to see how that Sonny Leon, who had a great thing, they asked him what he thought about Trump. He said, if I wanted to see a horse's ass, I'd have run second.
Well, when you watch that replay, which is the standard one, with about starting about halfway through the race, where there were 14 horses ahead of Rich Strike, 14 horses. And somehow through, I thought, one of the best rides I've just ever seen, ever. And of course, the horse had a lot in the tank at the end there. It's just incredible. I mean, I watch it, and I'm happy to watch it again.
Me too.
Is he going to run in the Belmont?
Yes, he is.
Good.
I mean, as of right now, he is.
Yeah, I'll tell you this. Take Mo Donegal.
Bet Mo Donegal in the Belmont. That horse is going to win.
Okay. Okay. Hey, Roger Altman, thank you. You got to get back to work.
Thank you.
All right, guys. Appreciate it. It was terrific. Take care.
See you later.
All right, James, now we have our questions. God, these questions are good. And it just, the thing that really, really bothers me is the ones we don't use, because they're all so good. So keep, if we don't get to you this week, send them in again, because we'll get to you maybe next week. All right, James, our first question is from Tom in Wendell, North Carolina, who says the minimum wage is still $7.25 an hour. This is a 9/11 emergency. Why aren't Democrats making more of it or some sort of deal to get it up? Make the Republicans vote on it. He also says he loves the show and he loves low-carb magic spoon all the way.
Well, he's got a good point. In 2020, they put the minimum wage on the ballot in Florida, in a race that we famously did not do that well in. And it was a $15 minimum wage, and it passed with 67%. This stuff is enormously popular. It helped people. I'm sure Sinema's been, they had enough contributions and she won't vote for it, but make them vote on it. Go on record. This is something that is wildly popular. As are most things, almost everything the Democrats want to do. I am told that they're going to pass a billionaire's tax this summer. I'm told they're going to pass something to do with prescription drug benefits. I was told other things that didn't turn out right, but these are reliable people that say this is going to happen. Even if they don't pass the minimum wage, put it on the ballot. At least make them deal with it. And yep, it gives you a little bit of an argument here. But I think the guy's spot on. We know this is popular. We don't know it just from polling. We know it from actual voting in an actual state. It's wildly popular, as it should be.
Totally concur. Sue in Cumberland, Rhode Island, says the great replacement theory, the Tucker Carlson, Laura Ingraham nonsense, already happened when European settlers intermarried with the indigenous non-white people of the Americas. I also would point out, Sue, that when the Italians and the Irish and the Germans and the Polish were immigrating to America, there was a similar complaint made. You're really going to dilute what this country is all about. That's why it's such total crap, if you will. So Sue wants to know, why can't the Democrats fight this ridiculous far-right theory with facts? And I think you're right, Sue. If you know, let people know that what this is pure and simple racism. That's what it's all about. James?
Well, okay, we start from a political point of view. All right, so I've seen this done 1,000 times. So he said, I'm gonna list your names of some groups of people and tell me if you think favorably or unfavorably about it. But you might go pro-life groups. They might go to National Rifle Association, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, all right, Hollywood filmmakers. Right? Immigrants. Immigrants score very well. People are very favorably disposed toward immigrants. And the way that they frame it is they're against all immigration, of course. What they don't like is to have total disorder. But I think the Democrats need to be very offensive about it, very much on the offensive. I think we have the strong hand when we talk about immigration. And I don't think we talk about it enough, not the stupid open border stuff, but, you know, once they say something that ignorant or silly, it pretty much drowns out the other message, but we should, like, push this. We fought for immigration. What do you think is going to solve the labor shortage? What do you think is going to solve the crisis in entitlements? Well, more people paying. I mean, it's day in and day out, man, I see immigration working in a very positive way for America. I really do. I'm very favorably disposed of it, and I think it can be a winner political issue. I really do.
Agreed. We have two questions, which I'm going to combine about Pennsylvania, the chaotic Pennsylvania race. Greg, who lives now in Aliso Viejo, California, but it's via New Orleans, he notes that McCormick led an election night. The next morning, Oz passed him. Based on Trump's comments about rigged elections, doesn't this make all this everything in this election rigged? And so he's really looking for a comment on what's happening there. And David in Pittsburgh also asked about the really chaotic Pennsylvania race, where you have a Republican race that isn't decided and a Democratic candidate who spent 10 days in the hospital. We're not quite sure what the status is. But I've never quite seen anything like Pennsylvania a couple weeks after the primary, James.
No, you're right. I think that most people feel like if things go the way they are, that McCormick will probably end up with the most votes, but it'll take a long time. I was on television.
And Lord knows what he may have to do to get there.
Right. And I thought that Perdue would get about 32, 33 in Georgia, because that was Trump was able to get for J.D. Vance and Dr. Oz. As it turned out, he got 23, 24. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He was running against an incumbent, which probably made some difference, but that was a pretty stunningly low number there. In terms of Pennsylvania, you're right. I think Fetterman's going to have to, you know, based on the story that I saw in the New York Times, and I know that reporter Gina Collada, and she's another reporter with it, is a very good medical reporter. She's very good. She'd have been around for a long time. And, you know, I hope he's better, and I hope he answers questions to get this behind him, because I think he's going to have to do it before it's over, and that he can get to just starting ripping and running in this general election. And, you know, the other big issue they have is Mastriano. They you know, it's not like in 1988, the gubernatorial candidate. You're not going to have, like you used to have, you know, massive number of people voting for Democratic for governor and Republican for senator. That just doesn't happen anymore. And if it's a bad enough year, I hate to say this, I could see Mastriano getting to be governor of Pennsylvania, which would be a disaster on a level we can't even imagine. Fetterman's got to tie him in there really hard to the whole operation. And you got to make, if it's McCormick or even Oz, you know, you have to make them answer for him in many ways. And they're not going to want to do it. They're going to walk around in a fleece vest.
I talked to someone who knows Pennsylvania politics, and they said they thought Oz probably got slightly more votes, but that McCormick will steal it. And I said, why? I said, because he's hired everything. He's hired every high-powered lawyer. He's got a lawyer in every single county, and he's got some of the Trump thugs working for him. But for Fetterman, the key is he's got to be transparent. He hasn't been transparent about his sickness. Maybe it's relatively mild, like he says, but he has to let us know soon what kind of health he's in. And if he's in good health, he can win that race.
Yeah.
Michael, it just says, Michael, you know, I'm going to read your question, but I'm upset with you because you say Michael in the USA. Well, you got to do better than that. We got to know where in the USA. But Michael does ask a good question. He said, if not for Manchin and Sinema stopping his reconciliation, the Biden bill, we'd be in a different place. Why hasn't more been done to present the reality? Why can't Democrats capitalize on it? Was a lost opportunity, but it's not the president's fault. I would just add, Michael, also, why don't Democrats talk about what Biden has done? There have been some big things that have happened. I mean, the first COVID relief, maybe it was a little bit too excessive, but it helped a lot of people. The first infrastructure bill, major infrastructure bill that's passed in decades, and a lot of good appointments. Talk not about what hasn't been done, but what has been done.
Well, yes, and again, this is something that I have this fixation on, is the biggest problem we have is Biden's number among Democrats. In the AP poll, it was 73. Trump used to get 95 among Republicans. And the reason is, of course, Democrats are being told by other Democrats that Biden hadn't done that much. I still have confidence that they're going to have some major legislative accomplishments this summer. I know that they think they line up the votes and they think they have them. and it'll be on something that is wildly popular, and it'll be like a minimum tax on billionaires, and it'll be something in the direction of making big pharma negotiate with drug prices. I'm sure it will be predictably criticized as not enough and too little, too late, you know, everything else. We've been talking about infrastructure since we built the interstate highway system. Right? It's the first president to ever get it done since Eisenhower. And, you know, we talk about it insufficiently, or we act like it didn't happen. So they get these legislative accomplishments over the summer, and it kind of people to refocus on the Biden record. And these people start shutting up about how Joe Biden hadn't done anything for you when he demonstrably has done a lot, not just for you, but for the country.
Yep. The next question is a good question, though I'm not sure it's coming from the best place for this question. John in Sonoma, California, asked a really good question. He says, many in rural America feel abandoned by the educated, with their towns devastated in the post-industrial America. The Democrats answer with wonky policy, which, you know, actually probably would help, but there's no emotional fusion to contrast with the rage and despair. So what is the deep emotional message the Democrats need to make to those who are hopeless and turning to the MAGA rage?
That guy has asked the best question observation in the history of this show or any other show. This is something that I've been on, of course, but, you know, climate is the only major movement, social or political, that refuses to use any emotion. There's no song, there's no bumper sticker, there's no logo, there's no anything. And you're right, we have to, I thought this at one time, it is a just article of faith among Democrats that if you have good policy, you execute good policy, and you help people, then people will reward you by voting for you. That is not true. That might be true a little bit, but not near as much as we think. And what they do is they connect a lot of hot button emotional and cultural issues to keep on. People want more gun control. Don't kid yourself. People want women to have choices when it comes to the health care and reproductive health care. People want that. You know, people want taxes on the wealthy. People want to do something about big pharma, and we have to frame this, and we have to frame it in a way that people are culturally comfortable with it. And our listener is so right, and a lot of what comes down, you know, is people in San Francisco give the aura that they look down on people in Sonoma. And I understand how you feel that way. I understand how your neighbors feel that way. And the party has become too responsive and too led by its overeducated white urban base. And that's a lot of the problem. And what I hear from your question is that observation that you're making from, you know, one of the, I think, most remarkable areas of the country. It's certainly beautiful, and the products they have out there are great. But Sonoma County is very rural. It's very agriculture. And I think what our listener is saying is something that every listener to this show should pay particular attention to.
Yeah. You know, spend time in a lot of these rural areas, but I was in some in both West Virginia and Pennsylvania. And Trump, as awful as he is, he plays to their fears, he plays to their insecurities, he plays to the fact that elites look down on him, and they think he's one of them. He didn't do a goddamn thing for them, but he's conned them. And in part, he's been more successful in conning them because of just what you just said, the Democrats not forfeiting, but just not really competing the way they should, not having the kind of messages they ought to have. So maybe it'll change.
And they're way too attentive to the educated urban base.
The final question comes from Shane in Minneapolis. Unless something terribly unexpected happens, when all is said and done, will Mitch McConnell have done more damage to American democracy than any other political leader? Post call, James.
What did Roger Taney, how much? Let's just say he's done a lot. Right. But look at the damage that George W. Bush did. A war.
Not to mention Donald Trump, of course. Yeah.
Not even to mention Trump. Okay. I don't know. But he's done a lot. If you sort of try to quantify it. By the way, he is by far less popular than Biden, Schumer, Pelosi, anybody. He is the single, across the board, most unpopular public official in America.
Wow,
and, of course, they would make what they made into Hillary or Pelosi or, you know, people on our, or even Harris, who are also more substantially popular. I think anybody's more popular than Mitch McConnell. But we've not been able to effectively and emotionally use him as a way to get votes. Maybe we'll think of something this term. I don't know.
Yep.
Why is every Democrat running for Congress, are you going to vote for Nancy Pelosi to speak? Well, every fucking Republican ought to answer the question. Are you going to vote for Mitch McConnell to be majority leader? I'd ask McCormick or Oz, whoever it is, right to their face.
Yeah, I agree. Or House members, are you going to vote for Kevin McCarthy?
Vote for Chuck Schumer. No. Yeah. Right, yeah. Right. They just do that. And all we do, well, I'm going to look at a variety of things. You know, as I'm going to cast ballot for leadership and, you know, who can do the most, blah, 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 blah. You know, it just oozes weakness. Oozes weakness.
Good questions from New Zealand to New Orleans to Sonoma to Minneapolis. So keep them coming. The ones we didn't get to this week, we'll try to get to next week. Thank you, listeners, very much. Hey, James, now for the outrage of the week. These are, you know, mine, I confess ahead of time, is pretty tepid compared to some of the dreadful things going on. But, you know, it's still an annoying outrage. Kellyanne Conway, a Trump enabler, has published her memoir. I'll take a pass. There are important books I'm trying to get to. This isn't one of them. It was Conway who coined that Orwellian term, alternative facts. But I did read the account by that star Washington Post reporter, Ashley Parker. And it's clear the book is self-serving. Now, that's nothing new. Score settling with the likes of Jared and Ivanka Kushner. You know, that sort of is nice. And really unseemly asides about her internal family problems. But to me, the cruncher, the worst of all, was her claim. Now, James, I want you to listen to this. Her claim that Donald Trump is a feminist. He is a prominent feminist, according to Kellyanne Conway. Why? Because, she says, he elevated and supported her to, quote, crack the glass ceiling for women, end quote. You know, I thought that Madeleine Albright and Hillary Clinton and Condoleezza Rice shattered a lot more glass. Now, Donald Trump is no more a feminist than I am a cardinal, or than the Pope is a Muslim. He has a long record, both professionally and personally, as a misogynist. And with this absurd claim, the Kellyanne Conway book appears to be written in alternative facts.
Well, man, of course, everything you say is true. There's nothing to, obviously, I mean, my outrage is this stuff in the Southern Baptist Convention. I mean, Russell Moore called it apocalyptic. All right, Russell Moore's biggest Baptist people of faith in the country. And what Willie Stark told Jack Burton, man is born in sin and conceived in corruption. The entire conservative movement within the Southern Baptist Convention, okay, was born, conceived in corruption and born in sin. It was started by two people, one named Paige Patterson, another named Paul Pressler. I think Pressler was a judge. It turns out that one was a pervert. It seems that one's a pervert, was accused, and I think in a civil trial right now for molesting a minor. The other was very, very tolerant of rape, and people came to him about this, and he told him not to let it go, don't bring it forward, anything else. And the whole plan for this was hatched at the Café Du Monde on Decatur Street in the French Quarter in New Orleans. And it was something that was rotten from the start, and it's produced exactly the kind of rotten result when rotten people get together and institute rotten policy and put rotten people in to execute that rotten policy. And what everything that you're seeing is exactly what these assholes deserve. It is not what these poor victims who were, you know, good people and they thought they were going along with something. A bunch of perverts.
They intimidated them and they threatened them.
Have I read the whole thing? No. Well, I'll see what Russell Moore and what's the other woman, Beth Moore, who's not related to him. Anybody that has
Beth
any
Moore,
sense
right.
of integrity.
And Michael Gerson, there are some.
Any, you know, there are many, 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 you know, decent people outraged by this. The problem is you can name the decent people on five fingers. It's the indecent right. people that's the problem.
I want to see what Ralph Reed and Gary Bauer and others have to say about this.
They got to hump some new accounts.
I suspect not much.
There's a lot of humping going on over there. He was up in the kids.
Right. They were pro humping.
Yeah.
And they didn't care about the victims.
No. Never do. What do you think? You don't think this is all bred out of the same psychology as the Supreme Court, or the same thing that you're watching Ted Cruz in South Texas now? It's the same shit. It's the same thing. And I don't know. I hope I'm surprised. Or maybe I'm just in a foul mood. But, man, we got some awfully shitty people in this country. I got to tell you, shitty people.
Well, we got more good people. The question is, what are the good people who are going to come out and vote and participate and voice their views? If they leave it to the others, then they get what they deserve.
But if history is any guide, they're going to stay at home. You know, they're going to shoot children and they're going to, you know, rape, you know, congregants. They're going to do all the stuff that they're accustomed to doing. And we'll say, well, I didn't go because I didn't like high gas prices. All right. It's just I got to get in a better mood here. Let's do something else.
You will. I know you. You will. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Real Paper, Blinkist, and The Jordan Harbinger Show in our show notes. We really thank you for supporting them. When you do, it helps make this podcast happen. To keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. Please rate the show with a 5-star review, and we'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.